so I really can't see the board too well. I think our audio levels are okay.
If not, I'll play with them.
We're joined in the studio today by Jonathan Johnson, candidate for governor of the state of Utah. We have a primary coming up June
28th.
28th.
Andy, thanks for having me on.
And I would just like to thank you for coming down to Carbon County and spending some time with us. You said you were over in Orangeville earlier checking things out. What did you think of the power plants?
I love the power plants. I see blue skies with white steam. I don't see any smoke.
No smoke, no haze.
Yeah, no haze. We didn't get a tour of the power plant today, but Courtney and I have been out to the IPP plant in Delta. So I think we have an understanding that the importance of coal and how important it is. And look, if we want on-demand power, which is, I think, what all Americans and Utahns want today, that's going to be fossil fuel. And that's what coal provides.
So we lately have this war on coal from the EPA, the Obama administration, and others. In Carbon County, we actually had one plant that had to close down because of EPA regulations. How, as governor, would you fight back on these EPA regulations and the war on coal?
Well, first, I mean, there's several ways. One, we have to continue to fight against the EPA. And I'm glad Governor Herbert filed a suit against the Clean Air Act. I'd continue to do that. When the EPA is making law, is what their regulations are, I think they're breaking the Constitution. The Constitution always anticipated that Congress would make laws. Congress has kind of given up what they were supposed to do, and they let these agencies do it. And I think that's a good argument against a lot of the overregulation that the EPA is doing. The second thing I think it's important to help us win this war against coal is to get the public land, the BLM and U.S. Forest Service land, transferred from the federal government to the state government. Because you know, we'll always have the EPA to fight, and I'm willing to be the tip of the spear and fight that fight. But today we're also fighting the Department of Interior and limited access to companies that want to extract. And if as a state, we own that land and we're managing it locally, we're going to do so responsibly, but we're going to do it in a way that makes the land productive.
Okay. Now, have you followed the Bear's Ear Monument proposal?
I have.
What is your feeling on the Bear's Ear?
Well, I think it's absolutely wrong that the president can sign away Utah land without Utah having any say in it, whether it was the Grand Staircase Escalante that President Clinton signed away or whether it's Bear's Ears that I'm fairly confident President Obama's going to sign away. To me, that's giving away what should be Utah's land. And I think it frustrates me that the governor hasn't been and the governor's office hasn't been more aggressive for the last 8 years to try and get BLM and U.S. Forest Service lands transferred back before this, because, you know, no matter what we do now, I think before President Obama leaves office, there's going to be another national monument, whether it's Bear's Ears or somewhere else. I'm committed that when I'm the governor, I'm going to bring a suit against the federal government to get that land transferred back so that 4 or 8 years from now, no matter who the president is, we're not looking at yet another monument.
Do you think it's kind of a vengeance thing doing these monuments by the Democratic presidents?
Oh, yeah. I mean, they look, they don't understand the West. They don't haven't been out to this land. I mean, you look at what President Clinton did. He did the monument not even coming within the boundaries of Utah. You know, he signed it over, I think it was in Colorado. They don't understand this land. I think it is vengeance. We're a Republican state. We don't particularly help Democratic presidents. And I think it's a tip of the cap to the aggressive environmentalists. And I like to modify it that way, because, you know, the people that I think are the true environmentalists, the stewards of the earth, are ranchers, loggers, miners, people who want the land to be safe and clean and productive for generations to come. But I think it's vengeance against the Republicans in Utah. It's not understanding the land in the West. And it's a tip of the hat to their very progressive base.
Okay. Just to shift gears a little bit, I'm going to go into something that you enjoy talking about, which is Common Core. My daughter-in-law is a first-year teacher here in the Price area, and her take on Common Core is she likes it because of its structure. What can you tell me about your feelings about Common Core?
So first I'll say I like standards. And I think if we don't have standards to measure against, we're not going to improve. And I believe in that adage, that which we measure improves, and that which we measure and report improves exponentially. I don't like the Common Core standards, and I don't like them for a lot of reasons, but one of the most important is they're dictated from the top down. And whether you think that's the Department of Education in Washington or the State School Board in Salt Lake, they've got no local control aspect to it. I would like the local school districts to be able to determine what the standards are. And if enough parents in Carbon County love Common Core, and that's what the Carbon County School District wants to put in place, I don't think it's my job as the governor in Salt Lake to say yes or no to that. I do think the state school board has to say those standards are an acceptable level. But if the Carbon County School District wants to say we're going to use the Stanford standards or the Iowa standards or the Texas standards, and those are all at an acceptable level, the local district should be able to make the decision so that parents have more input. At the end of the day, I think the responsibility of educating children lies with the parents. Now, most parents, including Courtney and me, have partnered with the public schools, and we asked the state to help us. But I want some input on what those standards are as a parent. And that's why I like local control.
Okay. I'm going to put my mic out here a little bit more so I'm not leaning on the... the second thing is the SAGE testing. How do you feel about that?
So I've been called for... last week, you know, before the governor did, I've called for the end of SAGE testing. And SAGE testing this year has changed. It's always been a test where... Students couldn't study for the test because they didn't know the questions ahead of time. The test didn't factor into their grade, so they really didn't care how they did. They never reviewed the answers they got wrong, so they didn't really learn from it. Those were all problems that have been around for a while. This year, the legislature passed a law, and the governor signed it, that said teachers are no longer evaluated on the SAGE test results. Used to be that was one of the reasons we gave it. Well, with that gone, I think we should just do away with SAGE testing. That doesn't mean we shouldn't have an end-of-year test just to measure our children and see how they've done. But it should be a test that factors into their grade, that they can review, that teachers are accountable for. But the way it is today, there's a lot of students. I've got a son who's a sophomore in high school, and a couple Saturdays ago, a bunch of his friends were over at the house, and I said, "Hey, how are the SAGE tests going?" And I expected them to moan and groan, and they said, "Oh, they're going great. We just answer C to every question." Kids are smart. They figure out how it works. They know it's not part of their grade. They're not going to do anything. What good is that kind of test? If it doesn't factor into their grade, it's a problem. The other problem with the SAGE test is there's a lot of data mining. We're gathering a lot of information on our children from a very young age that doesn't just stay with the school, but goes off to the state school board and the Department of Education back in Washington, and in some cases to businesses that have prepared these tests. And look, if anyone understands data mining, it's me as the former president of Overstock.com. Data mining is powerful stuff. If anyone's ever shopped on Overstock, they know that if they've browsed a product, that product follows them around the internet until they buy it or until they clean the cache of cookies on their browser. That's one thing in a commerce situation, but for children, when parents don't know what's being gathered, that's problematic. So I would do away with the SAGE test, and let's get a test that actually works and the parents have some say in, and that it's more of a local test.
Okay. I'm going to shift over to the JRI. Mm. The JRI, the Justice Reinvestment Initiative, has promised to save $256 million in 20 years. And in the last 2 years, they've emptied 600 beds out of the state penitentiary, the state prison. This has been an initiative by Governor Herbert. What is your feeling on it?
So I think it's a good idea. The goal is to have less kind of minor criminals go to prison learn how to be, kind of get a PhD in how to be a criminal. That, I think, was a good idea. The problem is it shifted that cost from the state and the prison to the counties and the jails. And it's tied the hands of many of prosecutors. As I'll say again and again, I believe the government that governs closest to the people governs best. And so to have the JRI, where we've handcuffed our local prosecutors and we've basically given an unfunded mandate to our counties who staff and support the jail, it's created some unforeseen consequences. Maybe there were consequences that were foreseen and ignored. But just like I don't like unfunded mandates from Washington to the state, I don't think the state through the JRI should be having an unfunded mandate to the county. So I think it's a good start, but like most ideas, they're improved iteratively, and I think we can improve on the JRI. And, you know, I've met with a lot of county sheriffs, including the county sheriff here in Carbon. I've met with county commissioners and a lot of county attorneys. They're not opposed to it. They would just like to have a little bit more control locally and make sure they're not being asked to fulfill an unfunded mandate.
I've been getting the same feedback from the local sheriffs and from the law enforcement in the area that the JRI is actually keeping people that should be in the state penitentiary in our local area. And it's accelerating a problem that we haven't had before, because up until this time we were able to prosecute them, send them to the state penitentiary, and the state did their thing in trying to reform them before they came back to the community. Now they're just being trying to reform them within the community without any punishment for anything they've done. And so how would we go about getting funding for it?
Well, I mean, just to comment on the reform aspect, when people aren't punished, the incentive to reform is not there. And you know, when you got a big punishment hanging over your head, I think that gives an incentive to reform. We've taken that away. How we're going to fund it? Look, I think the state's either going to have to say we recognize we've had an unfunded mandate and we're going to do it, or we're going to have to, you know, we'll help fund that, or we're going to have to go back and, you know, allow some of those beds in prison to be filled up again. I haven't looked at in the weeds on the line item on that. But it's unfair for the state to be telling counties, we're getting a cost off of our books and we're putting it on your books. You figure out how to deal with it. State should help anytime it's giving a mandate.
Well, and that $254 million is going to be eaten up really quick with new crimes that are committed by these individuals that, looking at the example of Corey Henderson, mm-hmm. that shot Doug Barton, the deputy in Salt Lake.
A mile from my home.
Yeah. I mean, that tragedy, I believe, could have been taken away if this wasn't in place.
We had I think this is all part of it, and the parole board wasn't working well. I was talking to a sheriff recently, and he said, it used to be you could get that penalty threatened at the first crime, and people, the criminals, got an understanding that they needed to straighten their life out. Now that penalty's not there at the first crime, and it's sometimes it's 5, 6, 7 crimes are committed before someone's going to be sent off to prison. Well, that's a lot of damage to a community, and it's a lot of stress on the local judicial system that the JRI has caused. I think it was a good idea, but like most good ideas, you got to refine them over time.
Okay. Next, I want to jump into the job situation.
Mm-hmm.
Utah has boasted that we've got a 5% unemployment in the state. Carbon County, 30 years ago, was probably the number one in personal income per household. Now we're right at the bottom. And so to make that dramatic change within 30 years, how could you create more jobs in eastern Utah?
Well, when I travel around eastern Utah and ask what the priorities are, this is what I hear in order. I hear economic development, I hear access to and ownership of public lands, and I hear education. The fact that education is third shows you how important one and two are, because no one ever puts education third. To me, one and two are the same coin, different sides. If we're going to help use the resources that are here, we need to have state ownership of the land and make it less onerous for to extract the minerals that are in the ground and the fuels that are in the ground. We also need to be looking at alternative industries that we can bring here. And I think the state is often too picky on what kind of industries that it's looking for. There's too much, if it's not tech, we don't want it. If it's not finance, we don't want it. Carbon County is uniquely situated in that we've got terminals here and a rail. There's a lot of manufacturing that can happen, you know, whether that's clothing manufacturing or plastics manufacturing or whatnot. Look, I've been a businessman for 26 years. I get it. And I know what is easy to sell on Utah. We've got a great environment. Carbon County is beautiful. Emory County is beautiful. We've got hard workers. We've got people with what I call the be, the know, and the do, character, knowledge, and work ethic. That's what companies are looking for when they're looking to relocate. We should be selling that and the virtues of Carbon County to industries that, frankly, that are coming back from offshore to onshore. I think there's a lot of apparel manufacturing. It's coming back from China and Mexico because the apparel industry needs it closer to the consumers. I know there used to be a big garment company here in Price before. So it's not like it hasn't worked before. We can bring these back.
Okay. One of the things that came up during your debate with Governor Herbert was the fact that Governor Herbert stated that he would like to see the presidential go to a primary instead of the caucus. What is your feeling about maybe the statewide going away from a caucus to a primary system where we elect and before we get to the actual primary that we're heading into?
Yeah, I really like the caucus system. It's not necessarily perfect, but particularly for statewide offices like governor and senator and things like that. It requires people running for statewide office to go to every county in the state. I mean, I've been to Carbon County 6 times in the last 6 months. If we have a primary, if we go to a place where all you have to do is gather signatures to get on the ballot, and you're trying to spend your time and your dollars most wisely, you do all your advertising on the Wasatch Front, you stay where the voters are. And I think that's bad. I think if we get away from the caucus convention system, that rural Utah will lose its voice. And I can tell you, I'm prepared to be a better governor because I've been to Hiram, Hooper, Helper, Hurricane. Those are all 4-H towns, literally and figuratively. You know, it's important to be to these towns to learn what issues are important off the Wasatch Front. And look, I've raised my family in Salt Lake. I think I understand the economy and the business market there. But I'm not running to be Salt Lake's governor. I'm running to be Utah's governor. And that includes those 4-H towns and all towns in between.
Okay. I'm going to wrap up this part of our discussion. But what I kind of want to do is have you give us, in 5 minutes or less, basically your platform. Why would the listeners want to vote for you as governor? Why is it important for people to get involved during this primary period? And if they're not registered as a Republican, to switch over and to get out and vote on June 28th?
June 28th, and you've got to be registered, I think, by the end of May, if you're not already a Republican. Look, I'm not a career politician. I'm not trying to become a career politician. I want to do things that make Utah better. And if those are safe and popular and politic things, they'll be easy. But I think there's plenty of things that aren't safe, that aren't politic and aren't popular, but are right. Whether it's fighting to get the public lands transferred, whether it's getting Common Core and the federal government out of our education system, whether it's saying no to Obamacare expansion that we saw the governor really push with Healthy Utah, I'm going to make hard choices. If I were to quote two presidents that kind of give you my governing philosophy, the first would be Ronald Reagan, who had been president for just over a year in the early 80s. He said the federal government operates under the arrogant assumption that states can't manage their own affairs. If that was true three decades ago, it's evident, it's glaringly more evident today. And it's in part because we look to the federal government to solve our problems and fund those solutions. And those solutions and funding come with strings attached, and we lose sovereignty. Now, I'm not naive enough to think that we can cut the strings immediately, but we preach and we practice self-reliance as individuals and as families. We should start getting there as a state. I really think that Utah should act like a sovereign state more often than we do. Push back on federal overreach, because it happens all the time. The second president I'd quote would be Thomas Jefferson, who said the government that governs closest to the people governs best. When you think about someone making a decision that affects your life, if I make a decision that negatively affects me, all I've got to do is convince myself that it was the wrong decision. If Courtney and I make a decision that negatively affects our family, it's the two of us that need to make a decision to change it. If someone at the city makes a decision, it's still relatively close, and we can try and convince them that it's the wrong decision and get it fixed. But if it's at the state or the federal government, it gets harder. So I'm going to work to pull power away from Washington and then push power away from Salt Lake closer to the individual and the family. And I'm not in this for the long haul. I mean, I'll do it for a term or two. I'll make sure we get term limits passed on our... Utah's one of only 14 states that doesn't have a term limit on its governor. Governor Herbert used to be for term limits, but now that he's running for his third term, he's not. I think that's what happens when you get in power. The trapping of power is tough. I'll get a term limit put on the governor the first year I'm in office, and then I'll take it to the people to amend the state constitution so that the legislature can't undo it quickly. I think it's important that we do that. So, look, I'm a constitutionalist. I'm not going to pass laws that violate the Constitution. I'm not going to do things that the government shouldn't be involved in. I like the Yellow Pages test. If you open the Yellow Pages and you find some non-governmental entity providing a service, the government ought to think long and hard whether it ought to be in that business. I'm not going to do things that we can't afford. I've promised I won't increase taxes. Some people say, boy, that sounds like a George Bush, no, read my lips, no new taxes. But I think it can be done. And I like having that constraint, because I think for too many politicians, the answer is more money, more money, more money. And when I asked Governor Herbert during our debate whether he would commit not to raise taxes during the next 4 years, he said, absolutely not. I won't commit to do that, because taxes are the economic engine of government. I couldn't disagree with him more. I think hardworking Utahns and the businesses that they run and build and the families that they build together are the economic engine of Utah. And we need to keep more money in our families and businesses' pocketbooks and bank accounts.
All right. I'd like to thank you, Jonathan, in your bid for governor of the state of Utah.
Thank you, Andy, for having me.
And good luck. And feel free to stop by our studios when you're in town next.
We'll do it.
And talk to us about how things are going.
Thank you.
Thank you.